And good morning. This is your host, Katie Kiefer. My co-host, Patrick Martins, will be joining us a little later on by phone. This is the main course on the Heritage Radio Network. We are sponsored by A16 Restaurant today. We are located in the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick. And my producer today is Jack Inslee. My engineer is Nat Wiener. Thank you, guys. So I'm going to do a little five-minute intro, and then we're going to go to Patrick over in California. And it's nice, I guess not too early for him. But Patrick is enjoying some time on the fabulous San Simeon Ranch. He's visiting with his pals at Hearst Ranch, one of our sponsors. He will be joining us a little bit later with Brian Kenny, who is, I guess, head of the cattle program there. Hearst Ranch has 155,000 protected acres of land on which they graze grass-fed beef of the very highest quality. So guys, I just wanted to tell you that I had the most incredible weekend, which started off on Friday evening with a very exciting adventure. I was thinking of Brian Kenny at the time and Patrick. And so I got tickets to the professional bull riding exhibition in Madison Square Garden. They finished up the exhibition last night, or tonight, I guess. So you can still catch it on TV. It was one of those moments where I can't say I would do this again, but it was like all American fun. And I don't think I've ever seen anything so glorious as these incredible bulls that come out and they are bred to buck. And so, you know, these macho dudes, I mean, the testosterone was flowing through the air and the crowd, everybody was whooping it up. There was a horse with a rider and a lariat in case one of the bulls went awry, and indeed that did happen in the second half. And in the middle of the program, like they have the first heat, and the goal of this competition is to stay on your bull for 8 seconds, which doesn't sound like a lot of time, but when you are sitting on top of 2,000 pounds of writhing, jumping, bucking muscle, I guess 8 seconds feels like an eternity. It was really, I mean, the strength and power of the animals is just incredible. So, but in the middle, in halftime, they had a sort of peewee adventure. Not Pee Wee Herman style, but like a Pee Wee bull riding contest in which they brought in, this is in Madison Square Garden, they brought in about a dozen sheep, and they had all these little teeny weeny kids who were probably 7 or 8 years old. I mean, they looked really small to me. And they had to get on the sheep, hang on, and run, make it all the way across the arena. And they had kids from, you know, obviously the tri-state area, and it was really mostly boys, 2 girls, and damned if one of the girls didn't win. A little girl from New York City won the sheep wrangling contest. She stuck on that sheep like a burr. It was truly hilarious. The crowd was roaring with laughter. And when it turned out that she won, the entire place gave her a standing ovation, which I'm sure if I were 8 years old, I would probably never recover from that moment. I mean, to have the whole stadium of Madison Square Garden stand up and scream their approval and stamp the floor and clap. You just don't get over that in any time soon. So that was Friday night. And remember, you can catch the last act of the professional bull riding exhibition tonight on one of the cable channels. And then yesterday, I spent the entire afternoon, actually almost the entire day, from about 11 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night with Ed Schoenfeld, who is a really highly respected and well-known restaurant concept creator. His most recent is the Chinatown Brasserie, which he runs with, Jimmy Eng, but he's had many, many, many projects, including I think he told me he set up, Shun Li, 25, 30 years ago. So he's been in the business a long time, and he has along the way become an extraordinarily, brilliant Chinese cook. So in the company of several people from both from my friend Catherine from the Food Network, and then a few people from the publishing industry, we had this 7-hour marathon of learning how to cook authentic Chinese food, which was just fascinating to me. One thing I did learn was that I don't absolutely love Chinese food. I find the flavors kind of ultimately sort of boring. Maybe because I've lived in New York so long and I've eaten so much Chinese food of good, bad, and indifferent qualities. mostly the latter. And but it was a real lesson in techniques, and that part was absolutely fascinating. And the amount of food you can produce for literally pennies. I mean, talk about recession cooking. Asian food, Chinese food is just, you stretch a dollar so far in this cuisine. And it was that part of it was also really, really interesting to me. It's something that, you know, if you're living on a budget, it's well worth exploring this cuisine. And I certainly, having been teaching recession cooking for sort of two semesters, I'm very mindful of that. So it was really fun and interesting day. And I hope to do it again, just for the technical aspects of it. And maybe the food will be, you know, sort of more interesting. The best thing we made was a veal dish, which is not traditionally Chinese, but the seasoning was, it was kind of a braise with star anise, cinnamon, ketchup, hello, was the magic ingredient, and some soy sauce, and, you know, the usual garlic, scallion, ginger startup. So it was a really, really interesting lesson, and the food was actually very easy. We made about eight dishes. It was extremely ambitious, but we got through it all. We had a lot of fun. So if you guys want, we can take a short break and come back with Patrick and Brian Kenny of the Hearst Ranch and hear about what's going on out in San Simeon and what's doing on the Hearst Ranch. We are back with the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We are about to hook up with my co-host, Patrick Martins, out in San Simeon Ranch in California. Patrick, are you there?
Yes, I am, Katie. Woo-hoo! Hello, good morning.
Top of the morning to you, honey. How was your evening? Tell me what you're doing out there.
What am I doing out there?
Yeah, like how did it happen that you are on the actual, are you staying in the castle?
Well, first thing is I was on the West Coast for the BSC championship game, Texas versus Alabama, the Longhorn cattle versus the elephants, and Texas's quarterback, Colt McCoy, went down in like the third minute of the game.
Oh, no.
With a nerve injury.
Oh, no.
And so they had to bring in their backup quarterback, who's a true freshman.
Oh, wow.
18 years old, and he had played, like, you know, 3 minutes the whole season, and yet he had to come in on the championship game on national television and try to lead the team back.
And
it was very emotional.
Very.
And they almost came back and won. They almost made up, like, a 20-point deficit. And there was a lot of fighting amongst the fans, which is exciting.
Really?
Yeah. Oh my God.
You mean like fist fighting?
Yeah. No, but you know, close. I was very close. Me and Billy, who is Ann Saxelby's brother. Yeah, very, very, very close to fisticuffs. because, you know, it's about hooking them horns.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's not about whatever the Bama thing is.
Well, you got your testosterone flowing at one of those. You know, it's been that kind of a weekend. I don't know if you heard the intro, but I went to the professional bull riding exhibition in Madison Square Garden on Friday.
Oh, I've been to that. I love that.
It was so cool, Patrick. Talk about testosterone.
It's like the whole Madison Square Garden, and then they only use like 2 feet of the whole arena because that's where all the, you know. That's where the bull goes.
Yeah, the bull only goes about 2 feet outside of the chute, and then he just jumps up and down to try to shake off his rider. But it was a lot of fun, and every once in a while, a bull would, like, take, you know, the bit in his teeth, so to speak, and take a circuit around the ring and menace the clown and all that kind of stuff. It was very exciting.
Would be really good at that job where you have to go get the errant bull and bring it back to
the cage.
I'd
be really good at that. Yeah, absolutely. I can see myself in that role really easily. I did kind of love them, though. And you know what was interesting about it, though? These animals, like, they would sit in the chute quite patiently while the rider sat, you know, got onto the animal. And then they'd open up the gate, and the thing would come out and just, like, shake himself crazy. And then as soon as the rider was off, he would just calm down and walk back into the chute and back into whatever it was he came from. I mean, you know, it was like totally the animal was as much a part of the performance as the rider. And totally understood what his role was.
That's so funny that you say that, because I just spent the evening and basically this whole rest of the weekend, I mean, with cowboys, because after the game, the next day, I ended up driving up to Hearst Castle, thanks to my friend Brian Kenny.
Excellent Brian Kenny.
I have so much more respect for now that I see the scope of the project that he runs. And actually, he's on.
Well,
right,
he's here. He's with us, right?
Yeah, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
Oh, my God, you sound great.
Well, why, thank you, Katie. You always sound great.
Oh, thanks, Ryan.
The difference between us, Katie, is that I have the face for radio and you have the face for TV.
Oh, honey, you are too nice. I don't think so.
Hey, how are we sounding? Can people hear us on air, Jack and Nat, or are we loud enough?
You sound wonderful.
Yeah. And Brian sounds really up close and personal, especially, I must say. So, so guys, Patrick, you're up there. You're visiting Brian. And, Brian, you are the director of the cattle program at Hearst Ranch. Is that right? Am I giving you the right title?
Pretty much. I'm the division manager for Hearst Ranch Beef for the Hearst Corporation.
And how many head of beef do you guys have?
Well, in the cattle program in general, we have about 2,200, 2,500, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
In my program, we have about 1,000, probably 1,200 cattle right now, and then we'll have a calf crop, you know, a new calf crop that are going to be branded in the next 3 months.
Why do you have to brand them?
It's a kind of interesting thing. I mean, it's not the traditional cattle ranch. Like, people think you drive by and then you see a few thousand head of cattle. This is a massive, there's two major farms, but, I mean, you know, properties. The one that we're on is just, I mean, it's valley, then, hill, valley, hill, valley, hill, valley. There's like three or four hills and valleys. Just huge. I mean, how many acres is the property we're on, Brian, where the cattle roam?
82,000, Patrick.
82,000 acres.
Wow. Altogether, Hearst Ranch is 155,000 acres, right, Brian?
Yeah,
I seem to remember
reading that. 10 times the size of Manhattan.
Yeah. Wow.
So you're driving around this gorgeous backdrop of, you know, it's like you feel like you're in Napa Valley or something, you know, and then there'd just be these little pockets of cows.
Cool.
That are just like going wherever they want off,
What breeds are you cultivating?
Well, Angus and Hereford primarily, but we have some other genetics and Shorthorn and Murray Gray, Charlet, you know, some.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's primarily Angus and Hereford.
Because that's what people want to eat.
Well, it's what we've been raising here for a really long time.
Uh-huh. How long have you been running that cattle program? I mean, not you specifically, but or both, actually.
Well, let's see. The ranch was founded in 1865 by George Hearst, William Randolph Hearst's dad.
Right.
W.R., as he gets called around here. I got hired by Steve Hearst, who's W.R.'s great-grandson, in the year, I'm trying to remember, 2006, October. And I've been running this beef program since then. And then Cliff Garrison, who's our ranch operations manager, he runs both ranches. He's been here for 23 years.
Right.
I mean, this guy, Cliff, makes Clint Eastwood look like a pansy.
No.
I mean, this guy is hardcore. And
really?
It was so amazing to see the things he sees, you know. He, like, looks out onto some field, and he's like, look at that hawk, you know, fly next to the kennel. I'm like, where are you even looking? You know, like, I can't even see it.
Well, yeah.
And he has the biggest trouble is that on 82,000 acres, these cattle can go wherever they want.
Right.
So when he has to herd them, I mean, you know, he might drive an hour, you know, before seeing anything. It's a very, very weird, different type of, I mean, it's a true grass-fed operation. But because it's so many acres, it's just, I mean, rolling hills of cattle. I mean, it must be, is it very challenging, Brian, to... for him and for you to manage such like a massive property?
Well, my job has its own challenges, but the management of the property is not one of them. And, you know, we have a team that makes decisions on stuff like that, but Cliff runs the ranches, and he's got a very challenging job. And for the cowboys, it's a dangerous ranch. There's a lot of vertical terrain here, and when you look at rolling hills in California, at least on the coast, and
which
the other
is where
thing
you
about
are.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at California on the map, east and west movement in the state, other than the Great Valley, the Central Valley, east and west movement is precarious. I mean, it's a lot of vertical terrain, and here, when you're driving on Highway 1 on the coastal terrace, the front side of the ranch, and you see rolling hills, it looks like rolling hills, but there are deep and steep ravines in between all those rolling hills. And so it's beautiful, very rugged terrain.
Yeah.
And the Jack Ranch, which is our other ranch, our inland ranch, which is in Chelan, California, which is where James Dean died. He died driving through the ranch.
Really?
On the highway. It's very much of a valley ranch, so... it's a huge valley with some foothills surrounding it, and so it's very different. But the challenges are manifold, and my job is really, I mean, I have some of the iconography of the cowboys, but I'm really a spreadsheet cowboy, I mean, which is where my, you know, my core competencies are not in roping.
And
or riding cattle. I certainly can do it and give the cowboys who are world class a good laugh. But
but you,
I thought you were very convincing
Rose
here at
Collins
Roberta's,
really
though.
Easy. Yeah, I'm sorry. What was that, Katie?
I said I thought you were very convincing here at Roberta's.
Well, I mean, there's a you know, it's kind of funny because you a guy in my situation could have an identity crisis. Because I work in San Francisco for a media company. But I'm in agriculture. Uh-huh. Agriculture's down here.
Right.
I have to deal with corporate legal and insurance people and financial people. And then I have the aspect of, you know, work, like my colleagues down here. I mean, we have totally different operating environments. And so I really couldn't work for a better outfit with better people. I mean, we had our company party, our ranch holiday party for both ranches last night, and
it was awesome.
Ooh, I'm surprised you guys
cowboys.
Were able to get. Let's see, what time is it there? It's only 9:20.
Yeah, I've been up since 4. Just kidding. I went to bed at 2.
Yeah,
but I quit drinking, so I haven't had a hangover in 6 months.
Woo!
And I still can get my party on.
Well, that's cool.
But yeah, so last year, I don't think I would have been able to do this at 9. At least I wouldn't sound as hale and hearty as I do. But
it is amazing how, you know, cutting that alcohol out does make it easier to get up in the morning.
I put in a good 20 years. I got pretty good at it. I probably got too good at it.
I'm an expert myself. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you can keep your professionalism balanced, then that's good, because stopping's hard. But, you know, I'm good with it. I've actually spent a lot more time focusing on what I'm grateful for, and I'm really grateful to work for the Hearst Corporation because I think it sounds hollow, it sounds just like words maybe to the viewers, but the truth of the matter is, folks, that I work for an outfit that's a privately held corporation. Our business down here, which is sustainable and groundbreaking in its own simplicity and regard for both the land and environment and the animals and the people that work for it. This is run by a corporation. I mean, we're corporate agriculture at one level, and at the other level, I work for a family, and I work for a man in Stephen Hurst, who really believes in doing the right thing. And this ranch that we're on right now is going to be this way forever because it's a conservation easement. And so it's a really unique place. And the thing I like about it is that, you know, it's real. It's totally real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a human operation, so it's not like it's utopia. You have human beings. There's always struggle and strife and beauty and wonder. And I try to focus primarily on the beauty and wonder and all the good stuff.
But well, no.
Katie.
Yeah.
You would have loved that party yesterday. I mean,
I love almost every party, Pat.
80 cowboys. I mean, hardcore cowboys. And in fact, like me as a New York City born and raised, like I didn't, I mean, I maybe guessed that it existed, but in some small pockets, but I kind of thought like it didn't really exist. Like guys that wear cowboy hats and spurs and, you know, beautiful vests. I mean, everything. I mean, you truly felt like you were in the 1850s.
I would have been in hog heaven, baby.
These guys are
loves me a cowboy.
Tall. I mean, you know, I mean, it's kind of beautiful. I mean, like to think that people still spend their days, 10-hour days on horses.
Yeah.
Fixing fences, you know, migrating cows, you know. I mean, it's a very, very interesting stuff. And it was a staff party, so all their families were there, and there are all these, like, beautiful wives and beautiful kids running around. And it's just a very different, you know, environment. And I think it's awesome that Steve Hurst, who is, you know, Brian's person he works with the most, you know, has allowed this culture to exist, you know. I mean, it's almost on the same level of a Ted Turner, you know, that tries to create recreate the bison migration zones, you know, in Montana to New Mexico. This is like the same type of massive undertaking that supports, you know, literally almost 100 families.
Wow, that's awesome. So, guys, let's talk for a few minutes about the cattle program. It's 22 head of cattle. And 2,200, excuse me. 2,200 head of cattle. And how much of that, I mean, do you guys have how do you manage that? What's the day-to-day? And then let's talk a little bit about the economics of that, because grass-fed beef, you know, is a costly enterprise. And I think one of the things that I try to focus on whenever I talk about the meat industry, and especially about sort of, you know, an operation like yours, is the economics of it and how can it be made to pay and how can we encourage the commodity beef market to move more towards that model as opposed to the model that we have now.
And so, Brian, seasonality, I'm sure, is part of all that, entwined within that, because that complicates your model.
Well, let's take step one first. What was step one?
Well, step one is you have 2,200 head of cattle.
Yeah.
And so day-to-day how operation. Do you keep them, like, you know, because you obviously have to move them from one part of the ranch to another. And on, you know, 82,000 acres, you have how many cowboys who are herding the cows from one area, or they don't know to move themselves? They don't come into a barn at night?
Well, the cattle don't hold on a moment.
It's not like a dairy operation.
Excuse me. I was singing late by the campfire, and
I love it when you do that.
I might have suffered some smoke damage or something from the lovely oak wood, Central Coast oak wood. But, 2,200 head. Let's just look at the San Simeon Ranch. We had a lot of folks last night that were there that come and help us to gather and do some of the seasonal work. Uh-huh. But full-time at the San Simeon Ranch, we have really two cowboys full-time. Actually, really one cowboy full-time. Ryan Pasco is the head cowboy here. We have a guy named Chris Herrera who does some mechanic stuff, too, and cowboy stuff. And then Roland Camacho is my production manager, and he does some cowboy stuff. And then Cliff Garrison runs the ranches, and he can ride. And then we have three guys that are the fence crew, and they've been here a long time, too, and they can ride. So we can mobilize probably seven cowboys and bring in a couple people if they need to do some major work. But the day-to-day stuff is one or two guys.
Uh-huh. And so the day-to-day is just like riding around making sure that one of your cows hasn't fallen into a ravine or given birth or...
Well, we can't really run it that way, so because of the size and scale. Mm-hmm. But there's a rotation, and in grass-fed production, we use management-intensive grazing, so that means that we move cattle frequently, and Cliff understands this ranch like it's a living organism.
Right.
And
unbelievable.
He's an amazing man.
He understands
this, how this place works. And so he'll move cattle, and they track. We have our inventory reports. This is like the spreadsheet cowboy part of it. We have the inventory reports at the end of every month. And the team here, Roland and Cliff, manage and track where cattle are. So they graze in a rotational pattern. And so the day-to-day work would be, they're getting ready to go into a field. Someone needs to go in and ride the fence. And riding the fence, if you think of like a flat field, it's not a big deal. But some of these fields are, like I say, vertical terrain.
Vertiginous, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So there's that part. And then moving cattle, so then you're going to move into the next field. I mean, that's a lot of it. And then sometimes cattle get out because there are holes in the fence. There's a lot of, when you have a piece of property that's five times the size of Manhattan, you do have some neighbors, there's problems, you know, things happen. I mean, mm-hmm. We have a herd of zebras that's on our ranch that's gone, you know, feral. They're you can't domesticate zebras unless you start when they're really, really young.
Right.
But, you know, that's an issue where zebras eat grass, and we've been in tight grass years, and so they have to be managed a little bit, but you can't really manage them, so you have to react. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, just because of the scope and scale of a piece of property this big, that's reactive. It's just fact of having a huge piece of ground. People trespass and try to plant illegal crops.
I can imagine.
That happens.
Right.
Katie, meanwhile, there's a visitor center where people park and they board a bus and they take some 20-minute bus drive through the property to get to the castle,
uh-huh.
which sits at the very tippity top of the highest hill.
Wow.
And overlooks
the Pacific Ocean, though, too,
yeah,
right? Because it's right on the coast. It's on Route 1.
A 20-minute drive of their property and then the Pacific. And then you also see an airstrip for, you know, planes to land. I mean, it's a very interesting,
very surreal
environment for the cowboys to work. Mm-hmm.
The airstrip's private, and the castle is owned by the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So that's kind of the day-to-day piece. And then from the economic perspective, I think there are a couple things. I mean, and I don't want to sound curmudgeonly or anything like that, but
you could never sound curmudgeonly, Brian.
Okay, well, you're very kind. The thing that's tough about this business is that, and this ranch has run the same way for a long time. Until about 5 years ago, we started retaining calves to finish on grass.
So you have what's called a cow-calf operation?
Yeah, we do. We do, absolutely. We still do sell a lot of calves.
In a few minutes, let's investigate that particular aspect of things, because that's a big part of the cattle business.
Yeah, let's talk about that first if we're talking about economics.
All right, let's.
You can raise calves, and you sell them, and you either do them at a spring sale or a fall sale.
And how old are the calves when you sell them?
About 6 months, called
weaners. How much do they weigh at that point?
They weigh between, depending on how heavy they are, you're paid based on the weight.
Uh-huh.
It's done on 100 weight. So you figure where you try to get, I mean, we try to get them to 500 pounds or 550.
And on grass, is that harder or easier than it would be on, say, I mean, all cattle are raised on grass up to that point. Is that not true?
That's a great question. It depends on what the rain gives you for grass.
Right.
So, and all cattle are raised on grass until they're weaned. I mean, they're raised on a combination of mother's milk and grass.
Right.
So
and you've had bad grass these years.
Well, we've had ever since I worked here. We've had bad grass, and
well, because the droughts in California have been terrible.
They have been.
I mean, you've had years and years of drought.
Yes, and we've run on fumes in terms of rain.
Uh huh. Yeah.
So, depending on your grass year, you can maybe get your calves heavier. Now, the way the calf market works is that you sell. You can either do what's called private treaty, where you sell directly to another person. You have a contract.
And who is that other person you sell it to?
Well, it depends. Sometimes they're stockmen, uh-huh. and sometimes they're feedlots. They're uh-huh. called feeders or stockmen. So what a stockman does, a stockman usually leases ground. Sometimes they own it. They need a lot of ground, but yeah. they'll buy calves. They'll buy them, let's say they buy 550 weight calves, and they're for $700, let's say. It's $700.
So you're
total.
Making a dollar and change per pound.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, it may be less. I mean, mm-hmm. it just depends. If it's
that's not a lot of money.
No, I mean, maybe you got $750 and you just hit the ball out of the park. But uh-huh. we started differentiating with hormone and antibiotic free and some of these other, you know, source verified, some of these other programs that cost you some money to run, but they'll get you an extra maybe 6-7%.
And why will they give? Well, why will that give you an extra 6 or 7%? Because if it does that, then why doesn't everybody do it?
Well, not everybody does it because it's harder.
It's harder.
And, yeah.
In what way?
Cattle grow slower. Depends.
They
I mean,
do.
Just,
they grow a lot slower. Right.
What the thing about commodity businesses, even like in something like rice or wheat or corn, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, the finished product or the raw material, I guess, is a commodity. It's still a result of a natural cycle.
Yeah.
And so, to kind of look back at this cow-calf thing, so let's say you sell your calves for $700 or something like that, $604. I mean, it just depends on the year and the weight and all that stuff. You can make more money by adding weight, but the funny thing about the business is the heavier the cattle, the lower the price per hundred weight. So it's labyrinthine and Byzantine and a lot of other...
The heavier the cattle, the lower the price. Why
the lower the price per hundred weight.
Per hundred weight. Really?
Why is that?
Yeah. So in other words, if you sell your calf at 650 pounds as opposed to 550 pounds, you're going to get a lower price per pound?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Let me see if I can find it, one of the cattle market reports here.
Well, because then someone...
Yeah, let me really bore the bejesus out of everybody, but I'm actually really curious.
Well, it's a vestige.
I think this is a very... I mean, I think people need to understand what goes into raising cattle and why it is so hard to do what you guys are doing.
Okay, so let's say the weight thing is a vestige of corn being cheaper than grass.
Okay.
And so the idea was that if you're bringing in heavier weight cattle, you're going to have to feed them less. So, I mean, it's hard to explain because it doesn't really make sense. Certainly not in the rubric of our business. But let's say, I mean, one thing, one of the reasons is if you lock into a contract at 550 pounds.
Yeah.
And someone brings you heavier cattle, there's a slide, and they actually get penalized for going over. So,
okay, right. That I can understand.
Okay, good. So let's keep it there, because actually I think my brain, I smell smoke in here, and I think it's my brain.
But, sorry, Brian.
It's okay. No, it's a great question, but the reason is that corn is usually cheap, and you can take cattle that are lighter and feed them with more consistency, and potentially what everybody in that market's trying to get to is choice,
yeah,
or prime.
Right.
I mean, select or prime, you know, it's like, so.
Well, nobody, I mean, select has got to be the cheapest, you know,
it
so
is.
You want choice or prime. And the way you get prime meat, as I understand it in the reading that I've done, is that the higher the grain, the higher,
yeah,
the diet is in grain, like corn, the more marbling there is in the in the end product,
right,
and the more marbling there is, the more likelihood of you being awarded a prime, you know, degree or whatever you call
it. But it actually just gets graded.
Prime grade. Yeah,
by the USDA inspector. So,
yeah.
Okay, we're cooking with gas now. So let's just look at there are a couple trends in the market, the price of grain and what's called the select choice spread and the choice prime,
yes,
spread. Prime is probably less than 1% of the...
Well, what I've read is that prime of the total cattle production in the United States, it's between 4-6% of all cattle is graded prime.
Does that include dairy? Well,
no.
There's another, and dairy cattle are another part
I'm
of it.
I'm not including dairy cattle.
Okay,
God,
okay.
Who's interviewing who here? Jeez, Katie, you know so much.
Well, I've done a lot of reading about the cattle industry. I know, it's embarrassing. I'm a total meat geek. I'm sorry.
I know.
I went to a webinar. I did a webinar.
You used to butcher, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. So I got interested in the meat business. And also, I'm a protein junkie, so I love it.
Well, you're awesome.
I like
Katie.
Eating it, I like cooking it, and I like talking about it.
You are awesome.
Well, no, I'm only awesome to you guys because you're in the business. I suspect everybody else is like turning their dial away.
No, I don't think
Katie,
anybody's turning their dial.
90 years younger, oh my God, I would be. I mean, that is so hot that you know how to do all this stuff.
Patrick, you are adorable.
Well, that voice. I mean, come on.
Oh,
anyway,
right.
I'm gonna leave
Katie
you
likes you. She talks high voice.
I'm married, so I got to be careful.
I get into the well, right. I'm also attached.
I've been.
So.
Let's talk about this. let's switch gears back, shall
okay,
we?
Okay. Let's.
The back to this. So we're looking at CowCast. So let's say, and we talked a little bit about Choice Select and Prime and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say we sell calves. Let's say we get 700 something bucks a pound. I mean, per head.
Per head, right.
And we sell them to a stockman, and he goes, and he's going to buy them. He's going to put them on some ground, and he's going to graze it. And we used to bring stalkers into this ranch and into the Jack Ranch.
So he will continue to graze the cattle as opposed to keeping them confined and giving them grain?
Usually for 3 or 4 more months or 5 more months.
And at that point, they're up to what, like 1,100 pounds?
No, maybe 7, 8.
Okay.
I mean, you figure
so 3 or 4 months
maybe 900.
On grass.
Yeah, maybe 900
pounds. So he's not quite doubled his weight.
Yeah, he hasn't quite. No, he hasn't doubled his weight, and he's going to sell. He's going to buy basically those pounds from
from whoever is giving him the grazing land.
Yeah, from whoever's giving him the grazing land. So that's the turn. I just was looking out the window, and somebody was making. Gestures to try to make me laugh, and they succeeded. So sorry about that. But
okay.
A bunch of kids on a ranch. So
what?
Okay, so that's what the stockman does, and then then he sells to a feedlot. So
how does a stockman make any money if he has to pay for the grazing?
Yeah,
he's got to buy the calf, and then he's not even doubling his weight, so
he's
making only a couple hundred bucks per unit per head.
Well, he does it by being incredibly savvy.
Okay.
And that's,
so what makes a savvy stockman?
Experience and an understanding of the land and the production of grass. And I mean, it's these guys are, you know, you talk about, you watch the World Series of Poker. That's great. That's just great. I mean, these guys sit in a casino and play, they gamble. You want to see gamblers. Look at agriculture. This
yeah,
is,
really.
Talk
man.
About a gamble. My God.
I'll say.
But, okay, so that's the stockman. He sells to a feedlot. All right, so that's, let's say that's your, you know, heavier weight cattle. You buy them for less. He runs them on grass. He pays on the gain. He sells. If he has access to good grass and he has a good reputation, and the procurement guys at the feedlots like him because he produces quality cattle, quality maybe yearlings.
So in other words, quality meaning that he produces consistently choice or better or high choice, as I was just told by Tom Perini in, at the Perini Ranch down in Texas.
Yeah.
He buys high choice. And so, you know, guys who are running ranches and running restaurants at the same time are looking for that high choice.
Right.
Right? So,
yeah.
Okay. So
we still top the video market with our calves. I mean, there's also a video sale where they come out and, you know, we're not Luddites, so they come out and they film the cattle and they do it on a video sale on the internet. And,
You can't. I mean, how much would it have cost you to take your calves to a market?
Well, you
that used to be the norm, right?
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, the feedlots came out of the Longhorn drive out to Chicago. They get out there and they'd be gaunt and they put them in pens and feed them grain, and that's how they got fat again for the market there, the mercantile exchange.
I see.
Because they burned a lot of calories on that walk, right?
They do indeed. Yeah.
That's a long walk. There's an Ernest Tubbs song called Waltz Across Texas.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want to sing it for us, Brian?
When we dance together, my world's in disguise. It's a fairyland tale that's come true. And when you look at me with those stars in your eyes, I could waltz across Texas with you.
Beauty.
That takes some some calories to waltz across Texas, but yeah. to march, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 Longhorns from Texas to Chicago, that's
1,200-1,500 miles at least, right?
Yeah, that's a long yeah. run, and so much of our business language comes from agriculture. For example, branding is something we do because it's the only permanent way to mark an animal, and there are still rustlers, and you can't kill them and hang them from a tree anymore.
Right. I actually, since I read Meeting Place obsessively, I do see that. I see that quite often, yeah.
That was another thing that that always makes me smile, is the fact that you read Meeting Place.
I was regaling the boys earlier, the guys in the booth, with the story I'd sent Jack, and I think I sent it to you, Patrick, the story of a man who stole a steak. And he had many offenses, so he's actually doing serious time in prison for stealing the steak. I think it was like in, where was it, Jack? Was it in Kansas, Oklahoma? I don't know.
They have a three strikes law like we do here in California, that theft could be considered a third felony offense, and you could go to jail for life. I hope it was a good steak.
South Carolina.
It was South Carolina. It was, anyway, in any case, I think he's doing something like 9 years or something, because he had 9 offenses, and he's doing hard time for stealing
a
steak.
Do you think he'll come out as a vegan, or what's the first meal he's going to have?
Maybe I should
send him a steak.
I know, right? You can eat it raw.
Yeah, so our beef, being grass-fed, it doesn't have the marbling that you'd get in a feedlot. Our cattle are free-ranging foragers, so they're like athletes.
Yeah.
And so the meat's leaner, and the fat has a different lipid structure. The cattle, it takes
it's quite yellow, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. That's beta carotene, and mm-hmm. you know, and then there's a. So it just depends again on the grass. I mean, our meat has some really amazing, healthful properties. The numbers are off the charts, but it tends to have just an off-white fat, and it's not particularly grassy. I mean, it hasn't been the last 2 years, and you know, but sometimes there are variations, but ours tend to be right in kind of in the pocket. There's a Hearst flavor that I've identified.
Really?
It's a little herbaceous and has a little zest to it, I think. So
good. Oh, my God.
I personally prefer grass-fed beef. I mean, I did a taste test about a year ago where I did a story on DeBraga and Spittler. You guys,
oh yeah, I know
you probably
guys.
Know those guys, George and Mark. They're really great. I love them both. They're terrific guys, and they really know their business. Well, I did a little story on them for Food Arts, and they gave me a Kobe, like a Wagyu ribeye, a prime ribeye from the CAB program, a certified Angus beef, and then I bought a grass-fed, New York grass-fed beef strip steak from the Green Market. And we grilled them up exactly the same, just salt and pepper and olive oil on my stovetop grill. And the one that my boyfriend Curtis and I preferred was the grass-fed beef.
Right.
Even though these other two were like, you know, supposedly the top of the top end. Hmm. And the flavor was just so much more beefy that it was,
right.
you know, it was like what we remembered as children, actually.
We had a filet last night that Chef Megan Loring from San Luis Obispo cooked for the party. That was, I'm not a filet guy, but it was.
Yeah, I don't like
it. It was amazing. It was amazing. Oh,
and
it's got flavor.
The hamburger was amazing the night before.
Lynn's in Cambria, Lynn's Restaurant in Cambria, LINNS, they make amazing pies, and they ship, drop ship online.
Uh-huh.
We do the same thing at HearstRanch.com. But anyway.
Tell them about the Alala berry. Alalabara.
Oh,
it's a fruit that exists only here.
On the Hearst Ranch?
Yeah, it's in coastal California. In coastal
California.
It was developed at the University of Oregon. It's a cross between a blackberry, a raspberry, and I can't remember. Thanks for putting me on the spot, Patty.
It's the perfect fruit for Harry Carey if he were still alive.
Here's the guy. So Cubs win. I just wanted to do as an aside just bring up something that came out of our dinner conversation the other day. We've had some slow food type meals here,
sure.
which is fitting since Mr. Martin's founded Slow Food USA. But I think our dinner on Friday night was about 18 hours.
Ooh.
And
how imperial, how Roman of
you. It was very good. But during the conversation, Patrick mentioned that he went to Vassar and that their mascot, because we were talking about Hook'em Horns and the Alabama Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
Roll
Tide.
It was a beer mug, wasn't it, Pat?
Yeah, we had a mug of beer was our mascot. It was very inspirational.
So the university.
The varsity baseball team.
Then we were talking about other mascots that you could have, and I thought, well, if there's a mug of beer, then there should be some bar snack mascots. And we thought, well, what college should be the Jalapeno Poppers? And I thought, when I start Kenny University, we're going to be the Cider Ranch.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, sorry, guys. That was
a dicursive.
We were talking about the economics.
I think we should just kind of run that
okay.
subject right into the ground because I really want to get down.
Wasn't
to the bottom
that good
of
that I segued back to that after
yes,
a Cider Ranch? Thank
you're amazing.
You. God, I'm
you're
blushing.
Such a good guest.
I am blushing. Let's see. So we were talking about the economics of buying.
Okay,
Cavs.
So we've gotten to the point where the stock man is about to sell his stock, his not quite doubled in weight cows onto the final program, which is the feedlot program, typically, right?
Right.
Now, the feedlot is usually run by the packer, correct?
Not always.
Okay.
No, actually,
but
not always.
But the big ones like Cargill, Tyson.
Yeah, they're Swift. They're vertically integrated.
Swift. They have, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I got to say, I had the same conversation with Michael Pollan out here because he spoke at a deal at San Luis Obispo at Cal Poly that we sponsored. I told him that, there's that oak smoke again. I told him that the feedlots are a miracle of agricultural engineering because you take cattle that come in that are living organisms with different phenotypic characteristics, you put them in a controlled environment on a controlled ration, and procurement guy for a packing house is looking at cattle, and he's thinking, okay, he's thinking of boxes, because in the age of box beef, as you know, Katie, you look at the size of the ribeye, the dimensions of all these different muscles, and good feeders can take living organisms like cattle that are very, and depend on natural processes to grow. And they can produce a controlled result.
That's right.
That
with a
corrugated cardboard
size.
Manufacturers can build a box around.
Yeah,
it's an amazing achievement.
Well,
and whether or not you agree with it, and people ask me questions like, "Oh, Mr. Kenny, don't you think?" And they call me Mr. Kenny, which is scary enough right there. But
I think it's great.
I usually know that's when
that
a mean cut.
Actually.
That's when a mean or a tough question's coming. My favorite one was at Slow Food Nation. Mr. Kenny, don't you think that feedlots are immoral, in front of 60, 70, 80, 100 people. I don't remember, probably 100 people because Wendell Berry was on the panel, so everybody's there to see him. He was a prince, by the way.
I'm sure he was.
But, don't you think feedlots are immoral? No, hunger is immoral.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly. And anybody that gets up when it's dark or when other people are sleeping or when they don't want to go out and make sure that the food that they're producing can grow so they can feed people, in that rubric of moral, immoral, I mean, they're a moral actor because they're fighting hunger. So,
nobody
Brian,
gets
I mean,
rich as a far as it's in the agricultural business. I think
no,
is the
nobody
moral
gets
of the story.
Rich. Nobody gets into this business because
the
they want to kill people.
Anyway. Yeah.
And in the age of these E. coli outbreaks, I mean, nobody's doing this to kill people. The idea is honestly to produce food for as inexpensively as possible. And
that's right.
There are a lot of externalities that control hide costs, and people focus on the hidden costs a lot. But the fact of the matter is that we should also look at the hidden benefits. Because if you're going to do any analysis and just focus on costs, you're missing something. So in my understanding of the world as a member of the California Cattlemen's Association, I love beef, and I think it's a great product, and I eat beef of all kinds. Now, we do something different here. We're not making a value judgment. It's not better or worse. It's just what we do. But the reality of the situation is that everybody that's involved in the chain has, they're not making a lot of money. I mean, it's the margin the average margin on that the Packers made in 2008 was equivalent to the drop value of hides and viscera, you know, skulls.
Sure. Byproduct.
So
yeah.
At one level, it's still a hide and tallow trade.
Uh-huh. How interesting, Brian.
The beef is close to break even, and the Packers have to play games to find their money. They'll make short ribs expensive for 3 weeks, and then they're cheap again, and the sirloin's expensive. And in our fresh program, which we run a grass-fed operation here, so we finish our cattle on grass. It takes us 18 to 24 months to get them to 1,100 pounds.
As opposed to, let's point out what it takes on a feedlot to get to that weight.
13 to 16 to get
right.
to,
so
you know,
in other words, you're adding almost six months to
yeah.
the overall life of the cattle, which means that it takes you that much more time to realize any kind of money on that
right.
animal.
And
meanwhile, you're still paying salaries, taxes, et cetera.
You yeah, guys are also a seasonal business, so you don't even have product 6 months a year. You know,
no.
So, I mean, that adds into the economics. When you're grass-fed, you don't have supply all the time, which is, you know, a challenge to
so
market
your
product.
What do you feed them then? You feed them hay, like horses?
No, they eat residual dry matter. I mean, that's so we have to graze.
So like distillers no. mash and stuff like that?
No, just grain. I mean, just grass that is.
Uh-huh.
That is native and hasn't been grazed.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So that's where the land management.
That's part of where you need
in.
The land, all that acreage.
Yeah, and Cliff mm-hmm. has to think about making a grass bank because it might not rain next year.
Right.
And but I mean, here's the deal: the cattle have to eat 4% of their body weight a day to gain
yeah.
weight, and depending on the potency of the feed, they may have to eat 4% of their body weight a day just to stay even.
Yeah.
So, you know the. This business, it costs us, I would imagine, three times as much. I mean, I'm not imagining.
You know,
I've
you're
the
spreadsheet
accounting.
Cowboy.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's scary. At three times the price,
uh-huh.
I think that's almost our break-even point. I mean, if you looked at it in a pure cost accounting basis, so we're doing things, I'm trying to build a business that, you know, that justifies our ranching habit, I guess, as an operation, and we're getting close. I mean, and that's why we're right now in the process. We've done business with a lot of great, great people. Heritage Foods USA is one of those, I guess, one
Patrick
of those.
Martin.
Patrick
Martin.
Patrick Martin of Heritage Foods
that's
USA.
Do you know yeah. Patrick Martin's, Patrick?
Patrick Martin.
Because I would love to get that guy out to the ranch. But
And
anyway.
By the way, you know, part of the reason we came is because John Caney, who runs a very old third-generation kind of distributorship for all things, is, you know, part of a group of people that Brian and Steve Hurst brought together to basically collaborate because, you know, groups like us need to work in partnerships.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in order to compete. So we're very happy to announce that, you know, probably they're going to sell our products on a website that they create and also, you know, help us fulfill our internet sale needs. So, you know, we're really lucky to be able to have been here and to see the Hearst actually help people like us, you know. And, you know, even this thing, and I'll only speak to it for a second. I mean, this grass-fed, because they only have 6 months a year, you know, it's, you know, I was thinking and talking to Cliff, you know, who makes, you know, Chuck Norris look like Dakota Fanning. I mean, this guy is like a tough guy.
I hope Cliff is listening.
He is saying, you know, I'd rather eat my stuff frozen then go and eat fresh commodity stuff. And it was the same thing that the salmon people from Alaska said. I'd rather people eat our wild salmon frozen than fresh farm-raised salmon, you know?
But I
so
think
it's
that there's a place
challenge.
For both, and I think that's what Brian was saying a few minutes ago.
Right.
Am I right? I mean, it's like, you know, it's
yeah.
great if you have the option. I love that we have the option.
Right.
But in terms of feeding a giant population like ours, what I'm most interested in and what I hope, Brian, we can talk about it on another program with you about is how to find a way to create commodity beef without creating, continuing the model that is happening now where you have too many animals crowded in, you have Right. You know, so much risk of disease. You're feeding them stuff that makes them sick. I mean, all of the things that we you know, associate as the bad ideals around confined area feeding operations, and take that model and somehow turn it into something that works, perhaps not quite as economically efficiently, but almost, but at the same time addresses some of those concerns that consumers have, and that they rightfully should have. I mean, we shouldn't be perpetuating a system that essentially is, you know, unsustainable environmentally, certainly, and does not redound to anybody's credit in terms of the way the animals are taken care of. So,
well, let me throw one thing out there for that next discussion, is that there are ways to do that, but they're going to require the ability to do things like graze the federal rangelands. You know,
ooh, that's going to be unpopular.
Boy, howdy. I mean, you know, if you want to feel like the Dr. Buzzkill, which I think is one of my superhero titles, the other one's the Dream Thrasher. But
Dream Thrasher obliterates Dream Catchers.
That's kind of a complicated discussion. But, I mean, that's the reality of the situation. I mean, we have the 1952... is not now, but people have this ideal of going back to maybe the 20s in terms of how food's produced.
Yeah. And without recognizing that the population is, you know, many million times greater
than
it was.
And my biggest concern is that, you know, people get fired up and their topics du jour, and maybe it's Darfur 1 week, and the next week it's, you know, airline security, and the next week it's whether or not Barack Obama has a birth certificate. And the next week, maybe it's American Idol or Dancing with the Stars or, you know, Cooking with the Elves or whatever.
Right.
So, and there's a limited attention span. You know, if you look at Twitter, Twitter is a 147-character platform for messaging. And 147 characters are about, you know, 4 seconds. It's about the attention span of the average person. And so you take a discussion like this that is incredibly nuanced and again, labyrinthine.
And brings in so many different complex issues.
Right.
Well, Brian, I'm told we have only a minute or two left here on this program. So this will be continued, my friend, because it's great to talk to somebody who is as knowledgeable about the ins and outs of the industry. I would actually love to get, you know, like a real commodity beef spokesman on here. I haven't succeeded in doing that yet, but I'm still working on it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
we should
and
get
really,
Cliff on.
Yeah, well, let's have Cliff on.
Cliff makes, you know, General Petraeus look like Paris Hilton. I mean, he is...
I'm still resonating on the Clint Eastwood analogy, because Clint is my favorite movie star ever.
Wait, what was the other one? Was Chuck Norris
Chuck
and Dakota
Norris
Fanning. Where do you come up with this stuff?
Patrick
I'm
is so smart.
I'm going to hire you to write some material for
I know,
me.
Right? He's
Katie,
so smart.
And the last thing I just want to say, I mean, Steve Hurst is an amazing guy. I mean, he was making BLT sandwiches at, like, you know, late at night, and he is just... a guy who
damn wants good BLT
to bring people together, and you know, I think it's friggin' awesome. And I recommend everyone to come to San Simeon. I mean, park your car, drive out. I mean, it's a you know, you have the gaudiness of the castle, and then you have, you know, very modest bunkhouse and all that. I mean, it's a very, very interesting place, and you know, for people to say even a word of criticism because you know the Hearsts are who they are. I mean, is absolutely, you know, we cannot stand for it. I mean, they are a model, and God willing, more people can, you know, benefit from the relationship building they do. And, you know, just because they're a wealthy corporation doesn't make, you know, one of the largest grass-fed operations in the country a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, wealthy corporation is not necessarily a bad thing, as anybody who knows who's part of one.
Also come and check out HearstRanch.com for more information.
Which is the new name of my new firstborn. Is
actually, when Pat has a kid, it's going to be HearstRanch.com.
Right,
I am looking forward to the christening of HearstRanch.com.
Me too.
Martin's.
HearstRanch.com will be a fast learner.
Yeah, clearly. And you'll know how to ride a horse. And rope a cow.
Well, yeah, we have a lot of plans for him. But
and Katie, next week we have a fascinating show. We have Frank from Frankie's, and we have Jimmy from Jimmy's, and I think Mike Edison. So it's going to be a raucous, fun show.
Another raucous and wild.
Mike Edison.
Oh, Mike Edison
is a
He's a one of a kind.
He is a monument to American individualism.
Yeah, he's a very cool guy. Well, Brian, thank you so much for the benefit of your charming presence on the radio, as well as your extraordinarily deep information and ability to explain the ins and outs of the cattle business to the rest of us.
Yeah, well, thanks for caring, and God bless America.
God bless America. And Patrick, I can't wait to see you. Have a very safe trip home.
Thank you very much.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by A16 Restaurant. And thank you very much to Roberta's. Stay with us. Escuto a correria cidade. O amor não vai olhar para trás, desencantar, nem ser tema de livro. A vida inteira. Hi there, we're back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is sponsored by A16 Restaurant, and we're broadcasting from the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. My producer today is Jack Inslee. My engineer is Nat Wiener. And we just spent an hour chatting up the beef industry with Patrick Martins and Brian Kenny of the Hearst Ranch. And we're switching gears now and going over to Eric Hoffner of the Orion Grassroots Organization. The Orion Grassroots Network, right?
Correct.
And Eric, thanks so much for being on the show with us today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
I was blown away by the website, I have to tell you. I mean, there was so much information on there that I couldn't even sort of like, you know, begin to ask you questions because it was just obviously we have a lot to talk about in there. Can we just start with a little bit? I mean, you're part of the Orion Grassroots Network, which is quite separate from the Orion Society, the Orion Magazine. You guys have a jobs board, you have internships, you're a clearinghouse for all these different grassroots organizations.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about your end of it, which is the Orion Grassroots Network. And you know, let people sort of know that where they should go to look for that and what you guys are doing.
All right. I like to describe the Grassroots Network as the action arm of Orion Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the same building with the editors of that magazine, and as you probably know, it's a nonprofit, 25-year-old magazine of basically ecological intelligence. I mean, what it takes to make a sustainable world.
Yeah.
It's pretty great, and we at the Grassroots Network work on getting the ideas in that magazine out into the world, and that is often most obvious through the network member groups that we have. Organizations like Heritage Foods USA and the Husbandry Institute, a bunch of different organizations that really got my interest going in sustainable agriculture as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we help land trusts and watershed councils, food banks, anybody who's trying to make a difference for people and planet. We help them raise money. We help them find interns.
Yeah, because it wasn't all just ag business. It was you had a whole variety of different organizations that that were grassroots based in the sense of being community based, but did not necessarily have anything to do with our food chain. I thought that was a really interesting part of that.
Right, and you know, it's all related. You know, even if we're a food bank, we have to be concerned about climate change.
Sure.
Right. So it makes sense for us to all be in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I have just have a blast helping these folks, you know, get the word out about what they're doing through our events board, or, you know, telling the editors of Orion about, you know, a great new heritage foods program in Southern California or whatever the story is.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was fantastic. I also thought, I mean, if people are interested in, you know, jobs in the quote unquote green sector, you guys had some plummy jobs up on that jobs board. I mean, hey, the Glenwood Foundation here in upstate New York in the Hudson River Valley at the head of the Hudson. I know that organization. They have an amazing place. They have an amazing program. You know, if I were qualified for that job, boy, I'd be
I'd
be really excited to be applying
for it. They're a great group.
So,
I love Glenwood.
Fantastic.
But yeah, we have a whole the gamut from executive directors of like Bioneers to intern at, you know, Eco Farm and you know, downstate Michigan, you know, all over
the place. Absolutely. I'm going to direct my nephew there. He has like a 2 week off period in March or February. And his mom is like, oh my God, what am I going to do with him? I can't have him around the house. He's 18 years old. I don't want him sitting down in somebody's basement getting high for 2 weeks. Let me find something good to do. I'm going to send them to this job board. So.
Yeah, it's ryangrassroots.org.
Mm-hmm.
Just click on job board.
Eric, you are partnering up. I think one of the reasons why Patrick invited you onto the show today was because you're partnering up with Heifer International. Is that right?
That's right.
That's an incredible development. I'm sure most people who listen to the station are aware of Heifer International. But for those who aren't, Heifer International has been around. I'm sure everybody's gotten at least one Christmas card from somebody saying, you know, a donation has been made in your name to Heifer International. And it's a group that basically buys livestock for developing, citizens in developing countries, right?
Right. Yeah. Charity or a relief agency, really.
Yeah,
it's been around for 50 years, and they work to uplift people through sustainable agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by plugging animals that make sense into people's lives. And often we hear about them right through, you know, their work in Africa or Asia or something, where literally, you know, a goat or a cow can change people's lives.
Sure,
just
it can
having
make a huge
that.
Difference. Even just a couple of chickens.
Yeah, you know, supply of protein for the kids to eat, and they develop well, and a couple extra eggs to sell, and then they have money to send the kids to school, and the kids go to school, and they take care of their parents, and then, you know, a whole village benefits.
It's called breaking
because,
the cycle of poverty.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, and the deal is if you get an animal, you're a small farmer or something, you get an animal, you're bound to give some animals that you grow from that first animal to a neighbor who needs them.
Sure.
It's called passing on the gift, and so eventually whole communities are uplifted by a single gift.
Wow, that's a fantastic program.
Yeah.
So now what exactly will Orion be doing with Heifer International? How is your partnership going to work?
Well, it started because we have a mutual admiration society going between us. They love to read Orion magazine, and we are very inspired by their work. And one of the editors of the member magazine, Heifer, has a wonderful member magazine called World Ark, and they do a fantastic job with it. But one of the editors there saw my images in Orion magazine, and she called me up, and she pitched me on doing a project with them. So this whole project that I have on exhibit in Vermont right now.
That was my next question. Is this part of the photography exhibit that I looked at this morning?
Yeah, it grew out of that.
On
your
website,
they send me on assignment to cover a story of my choice, and I went to Poland, and I talked about what the Heritage Breed Program is doing there for the farmers in Poland, and we published a cover story in their member magazine this summer. And the images from the show are really strong. They're very portraiture in black and white, and very striking images, so we made an exhibit with them.
Well, what I really liked about the images that I saw was that it, in many cases, showed the interaction, the interplay between the human custodian and the animal, because a lot of the animals obviously have, you know, I mean, these people, these are not, it's not like you're managing a flock of 10,000 chickens in a big warehouse. You have, you know, two or three or four, or it was a lot of geese. You had a lot of pictures of geese. And I don't know how much people eat geese, but I know that they certainly use their feathers, and that's got to be a business for somebody. And anyway, that to me was the most moving element of the exhibition, was the human interplay with the animals. And,
I really tried to bring that in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if it was mostly about the animal, at least have a person's hand or their body attached, you know, showing. Most times they had to hold these animals for me because the heritage breeds from Poland are, you know, just like many heritage breeds, really independent. You know, not really interested in you know, being around a photographer. So, you know.
Even one as charming as you?
No. I know. Can you figure?
Unimaginable.
I know.
That's so funny.
So it was very natural. But that was the whole point of my photo essay, is I told Heifer I wanted to go to Poland and make portraits of this project and of the farmers and the heritage breeds, because it's an old, old relationship. You know, they developed these breeds over millennia in Poland, and after Poland fell to the Soviets, and they were, you know, told what they should grow,
yeah,
these heritage breeds fell out of favor and were dwindling on game farms and zoos. You know, some of these animals are down to a couple hundred left. And so Heifer looked at this and said, this is an opportunity to save some of these really rare and very, very useful breeds of animals from extinction while helping these small farmers. Because small farmers in Poland right now are really hurting.
Well, the you know, I have to say that a lot of the photographs were sort of like Walker Evans-esque. In the sense of looking at, you know, these old ladies in their babushkas and their buttoned-up cardigans and, you know, 50 layers of clothing and so on, and they're holding their goose and, you know, their little hands all, you know, swollen and wrinkled and arthritic and everything. And I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, this is life in the 21st century in Poland. It's, and you don't think about that. I mean, when we think of Heifer International, as you pointed out earlier, you generally think of developing countries in Africa or South America or whatever. You don't think about a country which has as majestic and long a history as Poland.
Yeah, a developed country.
Being, yeah, you know. I mean, you think of it. I mean, we think of it as a developed country, but clearly looking at those photographs, their development, you know, ceased right around the time that they were annexed by the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
The first time, I mean. You know, it's
there's a lot of small-scale farmers there. They have the highest ratio of people working the land of any place in Europe.
Is that right?
25%.
Even more than, in, say, in France, because the French have a big agricultural
community. Yeah, the Italians have almost as many as the Poles, but, you know, Italy, it's less so people living and eking out, you know, a livelihood on a small plot of land as it is, you know, olive groves and, you know, a whole mix of sort of value-added agriculture. Whereas, you know, the Poles generally, most people in some areas that I were that I visited were farmers, and they're all small farms relative to the averages, of course, in the U.S., but also around the EU. You know, about 7 to 10 hectares.
Wow, that is tiny.
Tiny, yeah.
And so this is truly subsistence farming then. I mean, these are not people who are raising enough crop to do much more than feed their families and maybe their extended families.
Although in the past and they trading have a few done things. Plenty marketing, but the other half of their dilemma right now is that Poland just joined the EU. And any surplus that they can grow or milk or butcher can't be sold at this point because the EU's standards are really high.
And they're not meeting those standards?
They're not meeting those standards. You know, if you want to milk a cow, you can't milk it outdoors, which is very common still. You have to bring it inside to a, you know, a covered concrete floor.
With a sterilization process.
Sterile, everything, stainless, you know, metal containers. And people don't have that. You know, and the EU is trying to help subsidize people to get up to speed, but mostly, not surprisingly, the support from the EU has gone to the big farmers. You know, to get up to speed. So,
well, one thing I know is that Smithfield has made a huge investment in Poland. Smithfield of, you know, the meat packing, the meat, I mean, the giant hog, you know.
Oh, yeah. Enormous hog farms.
Huge. And Eastern Europe, and especially Poland, has been, I mean, they have just absorbed giant, giant quantities of land, and I presume that they're giving people a lot of work there, otherwise the country would not have, you know, the government would not have welcomed them with
fair
such
a amount of jobs involved.
There,
about 3-4 years ago, it was common knowledge that Poland was the place to go if you're in ag business.
Really?
You know, all these big ag businesses, they were in trade shows and all that. That was the buzz. Buy in Poland, you know. And the Poles were very interested in having these big companies come.
Yes.
But it's not, you know, it's a bizarre kind of agriculture. They're importing soybeans from the Brazilian rainforest to feed to these pigs.
Right.
And, you know, it's just sort of like a colonial style of
it agriculture. It is. I was just going to say, that's exactly what it sounds like. It's like there's nothing Polish about what's happening there. It's like it's an American company that is harnessing, you know, Polish acreage in order to sustain an American model using American infrastructure, essentially.
Right.
So very different from the type of people that you photographed and recorded in this thing. So what were some of the breeds that we were looking at that are in danger of extinction? You had a lot of chickens and geese and pigs and a few cattle. What are the primary products?
There's, the Polish red cattle is a pretty wonderful kind of cow, stocky, very agile, very independent. You don't need to feed them very much. They give an incredible kind of milk with a huge cream content, so you can make a lot of great cheese with that kind of milk.
Why don't we see more of that cheese?
And,
is that part of the whole problem with the infrastructure in terms of not being able to come up to grade, as it were, in EU EU context?
Yeah, that's part of it.
I never think of Poland as being a cheese-producing country, frankly.
No, but they love their dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, cheese is something they're really getting interested in now, and it's one of the things that Heifer is helping. You know, not only do they supply animals, but they supply extension services where their field assistants go out and visit the farms where the ducks or the geese or whatever they had given are living now. And and they also train the farmers in different marketing schemes or how to make cheese or any number of things, agritourism.
Yeah.
So they're giving them lots of different tools so that they can stay on their land and develop, you know, diversify their economy a little bit.
Most of the people that you photographed seem to be older. Are most young people moving into the cities or moving into, you know, sort of Smithfield type ag, or was it just because, you know, they're more sort of interesting and picturesque, or you were in smaller villages, or what do you think is sort of the breakdown?
Oh, I saw a mix.
Did you?
Yep. But certainly Poland has a huge problem, even bigger than most other places in Eastern Europe, of, you know, brain drain of young, talented kids going to Warsaw or Krakow or London or Madrid, you know, wherever they can find work in computers or things like that, you know. And their parents really want to encourage them.
Of course.
But it's a very sad thing, you know. People are living a very continental lifestyle, far from their families, so...
Right.
One of the things that's nice about the Heifer programs is that they're giving people a sense that there's another way. And, you know, I did meet a 24-year-old who is taking over his father's farm, just loves agriculture, and, you know, gets it. Very proud of his Polish red cows. Loved parading them around for me. And he hopped in the truck with us and brought us around to some of the other neighbors' places that we
that's great.
Got to photograph as well. Who also had animals from the same program.
Right. Eric, what drew you to Poland particularly? Do you have family there, or you've always been interested in them, or I don't know?
Oh, you know, the program
it's
is
kind of
really
an interesting
what drew me, but I
choice.
Have a fascination in Poland, definitely. Eastern Europe is really neat to me.
Really? Why?
I don't know. You know, it's just a place that I don't know enough about.
Uh-huh.
And it was something I realized that maybe... people who read Heifer's magazine would like to learn about, because, you know, we hear the most information about the good that Heifer does through, you know, developing countries.
Yes.
You know? And it would be just as interesting to drive around the United States and visit all the things that Heifer is doing here. I mean, it has a huge program in the U.S.
I'm completely unaware of that. Can you fill us in a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, they do have an animal giving program, an active one, but probably their most vital aspect of their work in the U.S. is with urban gardening.
Uh-huh.
And distributing seeds and know-how to groups who want to develop food, infrastructure, and know-how in the city.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been, you've never been here to Roberta's, I guess, huh?
I have not.
Well, we broadcast from inside of two reconditioned shipping containers, and on the roof of our shipping containers is a garden, and we're in the back garden the next door lot, I should say, of a former auto body shop turned restaurant called Roberta's Pizza. Wow. And yeah, and this is just, I mean, the guys who run this place are, you know, they have several different garden locations. And actually, one of the things we do on this program a lot is talk to people who are doing urban garden and community gardening and all that kind of stuff. So I had no idea that Heifer was involved in promoting that kind of production in the United States. And I suspect that most people who are listening to this were also unaware of that.
Yeah.
So what cities, for instance, does Heifer focus on? Because New York is like, it's its own engine. It's doing its own thing. It's like, we've, you know, there's so many people who are so into it here that I doubt we need a lot of help. But I'm sure there are other places. I mean, Chicago, for instance, has now mandated rooftop gardening just for the greening of their buildings.
Yeah.
So maybe that's one place. But are there other cities that are sort of less, you know, like in the Midwest and stuff?
Sure.
Which is,
I think they're,
you know,
active
the agricultural
in Detroit
breadbasket, yeah.
But I'm not positive that you can learn about all of their programs at heifer.org.
We go on to heifer.org. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you, to go back to the Polish thing, sorry, yeah. But one of the guests I've had on this show was an author and a journalist named Peter Pringle, who wrote a really fascinating book about an early seed geneticist named Nikolai Vavilov. And Vavilov was, you know, came of age, I guess, like maybe in the late 20s, early 30s, and
sure.
Eventually was murdered by Stalin. But he went all over the world collecting, cataloging, and developing seeds and seed genetics for the Soviet Union in order to end world famine. That was his goal. His goal was to end world famine, not just for the Soviet Union, but for everyone.
Really inspiring guy.
Oh, my God. An amazing. I mean, yeah. I totally recommend this book. It's called The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov. The author is Peter Pringle, a British journalist who spent many years in Moscow as the head of one of the several of the British newspapers running their bureau there. And it was really, to me, it was kind of an incredibly ironic story about agriculture in an area, you know, like Poland, of course, I think of as kind of an extension of the Soviet Union, you know, being sort of stuck between voodoo, you know, would-be magical thinking about agriculture in terms of collectivization, and then actually, you know, keeping some of those agricultural traditions alive and keeping some of those, as you catalog the heritage, alive. So how did they, I mean, in the face of the way this whole sort of Soviet culture rolled out and Soviet agriculture rolled out, how did these people keep their little thing going, do you think? And is that what really drew you to it? I mean, is that what made you want to go there, was the sort of vestigial remains of a much stronger tradition in the, you know, in the early part of the century, of the 20th century, I should say.
Well, it was very inspiring to me that they were digging these roots back up. And one of the really cool things to know about Poland and the Soviet era was that they are the only country that where the farmers resisted collectivization.
Really?
Yeah. They said no, and they got their way eventually. You know, which is saying a lot. So they kept some independence, but, you know, still the Soviet, you know, sort of, and the Communist Party could dictate a lot of how everything goes, you know.
Yeah.
Here are the animals that you should be growing.
Right.
And that
here
kind
are
of
the
thing.
Crops that you should be growing, and if you don't, we're going to, you know,
yep.
put you in a camp.
You're going to bring everything that you milk to the dairy plant.
Yeah.
And there you go. That's your market.
Yeah.
But, you know, these animals, you know, clung to it, and it's a great thing because they're so well matched to what we need right now. Now, a number of them are described as being dual purpose. So they're either the green leg chicken, for example. It's great either as a meat bird or an egg layer. You know, it's great for
so
either.
So that's a genetic commodity that breeders here might be interested in, for instance,
yeah.
even.
Oh, yeah. And all these animals are highly disease-resistant, especially the kind of pig that I saw. Really amazing.
Which pig was that?
It's called the Zlotniki Biali pig, and she's a great mother. She lives a long time and is very disease-resistant. Just, you know, and that's exactly the kind of thing we need now, right?
Totally. I mean, I actually have done quite a bit of reading about the pig. I'm a total, like, I'm a protein junkie, and I'm a little bit of a meat freak. I'm a meat nerd, I like to call myself. So I have read that, you know, like the different breeds do have, and I don't think most people realize this, but they do have these very distinct and different characteristics. For example, you can be a great mother, but you can be like really slow growing or have like not that much or not, just not get that big, which makes you not necessarily like the greatest commodity type, or even, you know, even if you're not a commodity farmer, you know, a genetic mix that isn't particularly advantageous economically. Or you could be, you know, somebody like the big, I mean, the reason why we grow the big white pigs here is because they produce these enormous litters.
Yeah,
and they grow really fast, but they're not particularly good mothers. Or the Berkshire pig, which is not a great mother, but you know, produces incredibly good pork. Those genetic characteristics that you're talking about are the reasons why it's important to sustain and increase the heritage breeds. Because
I think so.
Those are the genetics that people, I mean, if you're a smart guy like Bruce, not Bruce Willis, but what is his name? He works with Nyman.
Too.
You know him. his last name is Willis, but I can't remember his first name. But he used to work with Bill Nyman and indeed still manages the pork part of the Nyman Ranch brand. Mm. And his whole thing is like, you got to take a little bit of this and a little bit of that to create a breed of a hybrid breed that is, you know, disease resistant, grows fast, produces piglets, gives them a lot of milk, takes care of, you know, there are so many things that I think people who are, you know, just in the business of buying and eating it have no grasp of. They just have no idea.
Yeah.
That these are the factors that go into creating a great animal and a healthy agricultural product. And if you lose that and you let the commodity farms take over with just their one or two genetic characteristics that they want, then you wind up with a less robust industry overall. And I think that, you know, what the kind of work that you're doing by publicizing these breeds and that Patrick Martins does with Heritage, you know, Foods USA is really key to keeping all of that information in play. So how your exhibition is in Vermont?
Yeah, the southern Vermont area. It's in Brattleboro. So,
but so people can go onto their website though and see your photographs.
Sure. Yeah, all the information's at my website, erichoffner.com.
And that's Hoff, as in Frank, Ner, right?
Right, and Eric with a K.
Mm-hmm.
But it's up for the whole month.
Fantastic. And, congratulations, by the way.
Thanks. And it's an easy visit. It's right off of 91, so if you're going up to go ski or what have you.
That's
in
right.
Vermont, it's right on the right
we
off the highway.
Certainly
have
plenty
right
of
there.
Snow now, so.
Yeah, finally.
And you live
and
in Great Barrington?
We're doing a number of programs.
Or you live in Vermont?
I live sort of between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so what are the programs you're doing? I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, that's fine. We're doing this Thursday. We have a slideshow and gallery talk. Where I'll show more slides from the trip, in the gallery, and more of the food pictures, which everyone really loves, and the homemade vodka, and you know the amazing platters of food I was presented with everywhere we went, and you know more color images and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then on 21st Thursday night, we're going to have a local food program where the Brattleboro locavores are going to talk about what it means to be a locavore in, say, January. We're going to have local food, you know, and make it good, you know, something that even Patrick would like to eat.
Well, yeah, because Patrick, as you know, has an interesting take on the whole locavore movement. I don't know how much
I agree with it to a large extent.
Yeah.
And what's really nice about, you know, say, heifer Poland's, you know, local breeds is that not only are they local and great, but they're really delicious. I ate one of those geese, by the way.
Oh, yeah. How was it?
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they make these incredible eggs.
Yeah.
And
that I believe. I mean, duck eggs are delicious, so why wouldn't goose egg be? But so what are the, just to, we're going to wrap this up in just a couple minutes, but what are some of the products that they make from geese? Do they make goose confit the way they make duck confit and, you know, preserved goose? And do they do foie gras?
No, I don't believe so. Mm-hmm. Maybe not yet. But
would that breed be, because I know it's a specific
breed. The breed would
breed,
probably
actually.
Be good. They're very fast growing.
Uh-huh.
And they're bred right out of a race of geese that winters on the Baltic. You know, so it's pretty pretty nearby, kind of local critter.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that's great about them is I think it's the stomach of that goose.
Yeah.
Is what you use for goulash.
Get out of here! Really?
Yeah, yeah. When I was there one day when one of the project participants was butchering a goose, and she pulled out the stomach. I believe that was it. And she said, "This is the most valuable part of the goose."
No way. I wonder why.
Well, that's just what you need, I
guess. Because, I mean, like, geese, they're not built like chickens. They don't have, like, the gizzard, and then the stomach is usually quite small on a fowl.
Yeah, it was fairly small.
Uh-huh. Fascinating.
I've got some good pictures of that, too.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not going to be there for the slideshow.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I really enjoy.
The other thing we saw was this thing called the tree cake, which is a 6 or 4 kilo cake that's made with 42 eggs.
Wow.
Yeah, and so you need a kind of chicken that's a prodigious layer.
Yeah.
And so the green-legged chickens that are one of those endangered breeds.
And that was what we saw in the photographs. And they look like Rhode Island Reds, I have to tell you, because they have that ruddy brown. I mean, even though it was a black and white photo, it looked like the feathers were ruddy brown.
Yep, they're kind of orangey brown.
Yeah, that's like a Rhode Island Red, which is also an endangered species, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of them. So we're doing lots of great kind of conversations around slow food and all this with this. And actually, we have a few dinners that we're putting together in the Berkshires where I'm going to present my slideshow, and then we're going to have a 3-course slow food, locally sourced Polish dinner with it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so we're having a ball with that.
I mean, my experience of Polish food extends to that which my Polish former Polish neighbor used to share with me, which was bigos.
Oh, yeah.
Or bigosh. I think that's how you say it, which I absolutely adore because I love choucroute, so it's essentially the same thing.
Nice.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I
but it's, you know, it's cabbage and pork sausage. I mean,
pork sausage, everything. I had this thing called cartacha, which is like it's a potato dumpling. Imagine an enormous potato dumpling.
So like a giant gnocchi. Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. Inside of the dumpling is an entire bratwurst.
Oh, yeah.
And you get like two of these just on for lunch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'd need a gurney after that.
I know. And my translator is saying, oh, you're only half done. And I'm saying, I'm full.
Yeah. No, I'm more than half done.
I don't know how many times I heard that.
I have to go to bed now.
Right. Exactly. I mean, people eat
but
so much.
Cold.
But, you know, it's totally fine. You know, and I didn't see anybody that was obese the whole time I was there.
Well, that's because their food isn't, you
and
know,
people are just
high fructose
corn very syrup. High nutrient food and a good lifestyle.
You think?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think
Well, in the countryside, I imagine. I mean, when you're working on a farm, you're working hard. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a whole different story. I mean, I would need to eat two of those bratwurst-filled dumplings myself if I had gotten up at 4 o'clock in the morning and spent the entire day, you know, hustling my bustle around my farm.
Right.
You know, dragging things around and, I mean, geez.
But sometimes using draft horses and such, that's very common.
So they still, it's not a very mechanized agricultural scene there.
No.
What area were you in, by the way?
The very northeastern part.
So it's very cold.
Just a stone's throw from both Russia and Belarus and Lithuania. Mm-hmm.
So very cold, and what are the primary crops there?
Root crops, hay, grains, and animals.
So their growing season is long enough to support grains?
Yeah, barely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can grow corn, but it's not anything to shout about.
It's not indigenous to the area. I mean, corn is not a Western European product.
No.
So I would think they would do rye, winter wheat.
Yeah, one of the farms
sugar
that
beets.
I visited, they did a variety of different grains.
Yeah.
Rye was one of them.
Hence the rye bread tradition for the Ashkenazi Jews. Yeah. Well, Eric, I'm going to wrap this up, but this has been so interesting. Thank you very much for participating in the program.
No worries.
It's really been a pleasure. And let's remind people once again, this is the Orion Grassroots Network, which is a phenomenal organization, which I have to tell you, they need to do more public relations, because when we looked at your website, we were, you know, myself, my producer, my engineer, we were just like, my God, these people are doing so much with so many really cool organizations, and it's just not getting enough play out there in the world. So I urge all listeners to go to Orion Grassroots Network to check out the Orion magazine, look at the Orion Society tab, and especially Eric Hoffner's website for his photography and the heritage breeds that he's photographed in Poland. And to go to Heifer International and learn more about the programs that they're doing, not just in the developing world, but in the United States and Western Europe as well. So thanks so much, Eric. And I hope you'll come back. You know, keep us in mind, yeah. Like when something new is happening, something groovy is going on with Orion or whatever you're doing, you know, give us a call and we'll bring you back.
Love to. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
So this has been Heritage Radio Network's Main Course with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. My co-host, Patrick Martins, will be back next week. We have a fantastic lineup next week with Frankie of Frankie's and Jimmy of Jimmy's. Mike Edison is going to join us, and I'm sure it'll be another raucous, boisterous good time here at Roberta's Restaurant. Thanks so much for listening, and thank you to my producer, Jack Inslee, my engineer, Nat Wiener, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.